When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
It's the Swole Patrol, it's the Swole Patrol today. We're talking about eating lots of meat and getting super buff like Sean Baker. He is here and he rows really fast. He deadlifts more than you do, I can guarantee it. And he dunks basketballs and has a huge cock. I've seen the outline in his tight pants and I know a big cock when I see one.
Wonder when that piece was going to
get out. What do you mean?
I wonder when that was going to enter into the lyrics. It was late. It was
nice,
late. That's all.
Full veiny member.
Wow, son. Oh,
this episode of Swole Patrol. Episode of Swole Patrol, courtesy of True Recovery and Hydrolyte. Hydrolyte.com/Dr. Drew. Our newest sponsor, Select CBD. Thank you so much to everyone. Learn more about this CBD product. Go to drdrew.com/select. That's my site, drdrew.com/select.
That's my site.
That's your site. Yeah, that's what I meant. We got a lot of cut and paste here. That's Dr. Drew's site, of course, drdrew.com/select. For a limited time, you can save 25% at checkout with code Dr. Drew. And listen at the break for more info on these amazing products. Today, we welcome back to the show the man behind the carnivore movement, Dr. Sean Baker.
Hey, can I just do something totally off? Because the CBD stuff, because I don't know much about it. I mean, does that stuff, do you find that it works for a lot of people? What's your thoughts on that?
It's strictly anecdotal. We don't have the data yet. I tried it. It disrupted my sleep. She tried it. I'm pointing at my wife.
Had anxiety the next day.
She had a panic attack the next day.
Because I can't do that stuff.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, there's clearly some
people think it's anti-inflammatory.
And you had me use the
lotion,
oil.
Man, the rub.
I've tried the rubs. I've tried the little bit of the pills. I've tried pills with a little tiny bit of THC, which is some people claim is how it works. Maybe I got a little pain relief. I'm not sure if it was anti-inflammatory or not.
I definitely get sleep aid. Dr. Drew,
it screwed
disrupt
my sleep.
His sleep. Yeah. For me, it knocks me out. It's been the greatest godsend since I'm incapable of using, you know, sleeping pills, the good kind. The CBD, man, half hour before I go to bed, it really does.
See, I, on the other hand, have complete knockout from melatonin. I mean, completely gives me sleep for 5 hours. So, you know, these biologies are very variable, very complicated. We will get some clinical data soon because CBD is like the new Bitcoin. I mean, there's so many of CBD.
It's kind of funny. It's a funny story. So my next door neighbor in my house in New Mexico, he wanted to rent my house for the purpose and eventually buy it because he's growing a big giant CBD. He got a license and he's got this big, huge greenhouse. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I want your property because I want to grow more. And I'm like, well, I can't sell the house anyway right now because this market's not good. So here, rent it and do what you want. So it's kind of interesting.
It doesn't seem to do harm. The jury is still out for sure on addicts, whether addicts should be using it or not. He is long enough into recovery that it's probably not that big a deal either way. It's so weakly psychotropic so weakly psychoactive. But again, this is all questions to be answered. Long-term use, who knows? You know, the anecdotes are piling in, and a lot of psychiatrists are using it for anxiety. I've seen that. So it's being used. It's out there. It's just I can't yet say it with great clinical certainty.
That's kind of similar to the carnivore diet with the anecdotes piling in.
Well, I was going to say.
We're seeing the same thing.
A lot of stuff.
And a lot more anecdotal evidence, though, with the carnivore diet than I'm seeing with CBD. Because this is why. Because the anecdotal evidence with carnivore diet is objective. I can see, physically see, you lost 40 pounds and your bench press is higher. Like, I, you know what I'm saying? Whereas CBD is completely subjective. You know?
Yeah, I'll grant you that. And the where the other similarity is, too, is, again, we don't have really long-term data on carnivore, and we definitely don't have long-term data on CBD yet. Do you feel like we have long-term enough horizons on carnivore?
No. Yeah. I mean, we don't. But, you know, I mean, honestly, and this is one of the criticisms people will levy, is that there's no long-term data. But, I mean, when you really look at the data out there, there's no long-term data on any diet. I mean, if you want to look at a long-term randomized controlled trial that you've isolated that diet, you know, it's just never been done. It's too expensive to do, quite honestly. And so there's, you know, there's epidemiology where they follow populations and they say, well, this group of people ate a little bit more of this and they lived longer, or they had less heart disease or less cancer, and so therefore the diet must be good. Well, that's really not a very good way to determine what you and I should be eating. It just really isn't. And I know if you know where Professor John Ioannidis out of Stanford, he's a probably one of the most published or cited scientists in the public health field. And he's come out and said just recently, he said that all the nutritional epidemiology we've done has basically not taught us anything.
Well, that's what Kate Shanahan always says, right? Kate, you know Kate?
Mm-hmm.
Kate,
yeah,
Kate,
deep nutrition. Also, yeah. Right? I haven't met her, but I know.
She's a biochemist, like, we can't say it. I'm a biochemist. I know when you can make – you can talk about certain kinds of fats. You can talk about certain things here, and that's it. That's what all we can really say. But let's dig in nonetheless on some of this stuff.
Sure.
I have a million questions. And also, I want to get a little bit into what's Feldman's first name?
Dave
Feldman. Right. Yeah, his stuff. I mean,
it's interesting.
We interviewed him, and he's trying to make a science. Again, I'm not sure I can reproduce his thinking because it's a mathematical model.
I know I fucking can't.
Well, it was challenging even talking to him.
Yeah, I mean he favors an energy theory of lipid transport. Basically, I mean, in a nutshell, I mean, I'm sure he went over this, but I mean, it's basically if you are in a relatively nutritionally deprived state, your liver is going to just ship out more fat via free fatty acids, lipoproteins, and then, of course, the cholesterol traffics with it. And then if you're in a relatively nourished state, it does the opposite. So that's why we see this dynamic. You know, if there's a nice study out there that was done on people that went on a 1 week fast, and they saw their total cholesterol went up something like, it was between 35% and 70%.
Right.
So it's just from fasting.
So the idea is a feedback loop,
right,
like many other neuroendocrine kinds of phenomena in the body. So, you know, my experience on I'm not a pure carnivore diet because I just like vegetables too much. And I get palate fatigue relatively easily. But my cholesterol on this essentially carnivore diet, my HDL has never been higher.
Right.
My LDL, I'm on a statin, so it's pegged right where it always is. My triglycerides have never went way down.
And we know that's a favorable – we think that's a favorable ratio.
Well, recently there's been a bunch of – I don't know if you saw, I think in the England Journal this week they have another
– I mean, it's again, all these other numbers are –
but they have another medication to treat triglycerides. They had a long-term multi-year study on a medication-lowered triglyceride, much less cardiovascular disease. So I felt like that was a pretty good indication of triglyceride and heart disease.
What about glucose?
Well, what about glucose? This is – Feldman gets deep into that too, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, again, he talks about this phenomenon of the lean mass hyperresponder, where the profile tends to be they're very lean, they're very, you know, you would think looking at them they're very healthy, and probably quite honestly they are, but they'll tend to run higher HDLs, higher LDLs, lower triglycerides, and their glucose can sometimes trend upwards, particularly if they're utilizing, if they're very active, and there's a on our podcast we had an interesting guy named Alessandro Ferretti who deals with a lot of Olympic level athletes, and they did some studies on these guys, and they saw that particularly guys engaged in high sprint-like activities, particularly when they're high training loads, their glucose went up into diabetic levels, and their fasting glucose. And they're ripped. These guys are totally athletic.
So crazy.
So we're seeing
So the way I would think about that, I would imagine the body is adapting to stress by being able to deliver through probably – not gluconeogenesis so much, but glycogen breakdown from skeletal muscle, probably, right?
Well, see,
that's the most rapidly available.
Well, that's where you want it, right? But then the liver is also going to dump some into the blood. Interestingly, I don't know if you guys know Jason Fung. I don't know if you were.
I'm familiar with him, but
he's got an interesting book called The Diabetes Code. He talks about, you know, what is the pathophysiology of diabetes? You know, insulin plays a huge role in there. We tend to just not even measure insulin for most people, and it's just a very important part. But it's really not the glucose in the blood that's causing the problem. It's the glycation that's occurring in the end organs. You know, whether it's the retinal vessels in the eye or the renal vessels. You know, when we see the end stage nephropathy and then also the diabetic peripheral vascular disease. We see all that stuff, and that's because of this glycation that's happening. Interestingly, if we look at fructose, is about 20 times more powerful of a glycating agent than glucose is. And so, as we know, our diet is, over the last 50 years, has included a lot more fructose in the diet via things like high fructose corn syrup. And so that, maybe that has a problem. I think seed oils, I don't know if you paid much attention to seed oils.
Kate is big on that.
Yeah, that seems to be very problematic. Yeah. And again, if we look at when they were introduced in the human diet, I think it was cottonseed oil back in the late 1800s. Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, and then they had all this extra stuff, these seeds they had to get rid of, and they didn't know what to do with it. And for a while, it was an industrial lubricant. And then, can't remember the name of the guy, it was a German biochemist, I think, and he figured out how to partially hydrogenate
Heinrich Himmler, I believe so.
I don't know if it's Himmler, but I can't remember the guy's name. But so then they figured out how to do it, and they said, well, now you can eat that stuff. And then we saw back in the early 1920s, I think, Procter & Gamble bequeathed millions of dollars on the American Heart Association to start promoting Crisco. And, whether that was a good thing or not, I think is debatable. But.
So now I've been on this diet I want to talk a little bit about the anti-inflammatory effects stuff, because I'm hypothesizing and not theorizing. I'm only hypothesizing that the major effect of this diet is it's probably the most efficacious diet for leaning out central obesity in terms of doing it. Not that there are better ways to do it, but in terms of sustaining it. Most diets aren't sustainable, right? This is a highly sustainable diet.
It can be.
At least keto or whatever. That whole zone, you're not hungry. So right, it's much easier to sustain it. And I have found, personally, that this inflammatory agent, I'm pointing at my abdomen, is successfully reduced and sustained down in a way I've never seen from other diets. And we know this is an inflammatory process. Yeah. And I wonder if certainly, if there are any adverse effects of this, say, on lipid metabolism, the benefits of the anti-inflammatory component vastly outweigh that, it seems to me.
That concept, that point of what are the risk factors, and you got to put them all together. We can make a diversion into risk of colon cancer, because I think that's an important topic.
But with the meat. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. But, absolutely, one of the things that occurs, if you're hungry all the time, you're going to cave.
You're going to eat
the cupcakes. Yeah. You're going to eat whatever's in front of you, because it's ubiquitous. Yeah. So everything, we're always surrounded by stuff. So, you can say, I'm hungry, so I'm going to eat whatever's in front of me. One of the things we know about a carnivore diet is it's higher in protein. Protein, even the people that are diehard calories in, calories out people. I had a debate with a guy named Lane Norton.
We had Lane on the show.
We and him kind of had a little debate on Mark Bell's podcast, and we talked about that. And we said, look, everyone agrees that if you eat a higher protein diet, that gives you a little bit of a caloric advantage. You can eat, there's some studies show 200-300 calories extra a day without any additional weight gain. In fact, a guy named Jose Antonio, who I'm going to have on my podcast too, is a researcher, has shown that he's had – people on the show in his studies where they took 200 grams a day extra protein, and that's 800 calories extra a day, gained no additional weight, gained no additional body fat. They preserve more lean muscle masses. So the protein alone effect, allows you to eat more. So if you can eat more, then that's a good thing. But then the question is, are carbohydrates, being low carb, does that have a difference? That's very debatable. Of course, David Ludwig's study out of Harvard just came out in November. I don't know if you saw that. Mm-hmm. They show that people, this is a $12 million one-year study that they did, one of the biggest ones ever attempted. They showed that people that were on a low-carb diet enjoyed about a 200-calorie or as much as a 400-calorie, depending on their insulin set. If they were very hyperinsulinemic, a 400-calorie benefit from going low-carb. And so that's at maintenance. So it does,
Let me just make a qualifier. 400 calories above your metabolic demands?
You could eat you could stay weight stable on 400 extra calories.
Extra calories above what your basic metabolic.
Well, basically compared to somebody who's on a high carb diet.
Yeah,
Those people could only eat 400 calories less.
That fits intuitively what I experienced.
What you're seeing,
with this.
Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of people,
however, I routinely eat about 1,000 calories more than I should at protein. That's a different problem.
But it's
routinely part of my issue.
It is a problem, but it's one that I wanted to bring up. I don't know about what your take would be on it, Dr. Baker, but for me, if I'm advocating for someone to engage in a lower carb diet, I would like to see them choose fattier cuts of meat as opposed to leaner cuts. And with that said, wouldn't it be
You're talking about to help them with appetite.
And satiety and, you know.
But now you're getting to very low carbohydrate diets and ketosis, right?
Either way, well, what is Dr. Baker following? I mean, well, he's a well, zero
but he was, but he was
diet.
Just talking about low carbohydrate at this point, right?
Sure, sure. So, I mean.
I'm just saying, with that said, though, if you a guy like you eating 3 pounds of meat in a day,
right,
four,
sure.
sometimes more.
Right, right.
Is there how is there not a risk of being hypercaloric when you're eating such calorically dense items?
Well, I mean, there are people on this diet that can actually gain weight and gain body fat. I've certainly seen it. It's not like it's, you know, unlimited all you can eat buffet all
right.
the time. But for most people, the satiety signal is pretty great. It's tough to eat 3, 4, 5 pounds of meat a day. I mean,
right.
it really is. I mean, I've done it, and I can do that. When I really want to, if I want to gain weight, I'll do that, and I'll have to eat past the point. You know, like when you're bodybuilding,
sure.
you got to eat. Eating's your job. You look at these top strongmen guys.
Oh,
these top
eating
body,
all day.
Eating is painful for them. They got to really constantly is. Stuff their face to put on muscle. It's hard to do.
I've often said when it comes to elite-level strength sports, whether it be bodybuilding, whether it be powerlifting, strongman, when you're talking about elite level, the training is a very small issue. Because everyone listening to this podcast, everyone in this room, we all like to train.
Yeah, training's fun.
Training's fun.
Yeah, that's the fun part of the day, yeah.
It's can you have 12 meals a day, take the Tupperware with you everywhere you go. I mean, that's the that's what separates the proverbial men from the boys in elite strength sports, you know?
Can you afford it?
What's that?
Well, yeah that's an issue.
That's
yeah.
your job, though. Yeah. I mean, if that's your job, you
it
better.
It is my yeah. job. I make a lot of bacon around here.
Good, making some bacon.
That's Dr.
Yeah.
Drew's. That's Dr. Drew's personal chef over there.
It's true.
It's true.
The next question I wanted to get to, because I think you brought up a good point. Not only is it very difficult to overeat meat alone in comparison to other hyper palatable things like bread and rice and things, I've found exclusively with carnivore. Aside from other ketogenic diets, there's something magical that happens with carnivore-only athletes that other keto athletes I've seen, and this is just me anecdotally. I train with countless guys in jiu-jitsu, Muay Thai, sometimes in CrossFit, things like that. That have tried a ketogenic diet and have failed because they just don't have the glycolytic capacity to do anaerobic things.
Wait. What lets them know that they've failed?
They literally cannot do it.
Like do what? What is it they want to do?
You get on a C2 rower and go and sprint on it. You run up a hill fast. You throw a punch.
They should be able to keep doing that.
It seems very difficult in. Given,
can they take a little bit of carbohydrate before training?
That's what lower carb athletes do.
Yeah.
Is they eat their carbs around training.
Sure,
I'm talking about a ketogenic
full
diet.
Full ketosis.
A ketogenic diet for an athlete, not an endurance athlete, not
right.
just a powerlifter.
Right.
Someone who does stuff fast. They seem to have problems doing that, but there's countless carnivore dieters that I've seen flourish in things like. Yourself with the C2 rower, BJJ athletes. You have a New Zealand All Black athlete that is, you know,
Owen Franks. Yeah, he's
that,
doing it. Yeah,
and
the
that is
level,
that's
yeah.
an incredibly anaerobically demanding sport. That's not just slight jogging. You're sprinting a lot, and he seems to be able to not only manage it, but again, flourish.
But maybe that's because they're eating above their metabolic demands, and some of that's being converted to glucose, right?
Well, I think you know two things with this. Traditionally, a ketogenic diet, people have been told to really limit their protein. It's
okay.
really limit the protein. I think they're for athletes, that's probably not enough protein.
Okay.
I think, you know, certainly, you know, as we get older, just as a normal human being, we need upper protein levels. I know there's people that will debate about that, but I think that's pretty clear.
I'm going to tell you, I'm not much about, you know, I've always been very skeptical of enhancing your immune function, but Mike will tell you, in terms of increasing my protein intake, I used to be more in sort of plant-based, more intermittent fasting. How many times a year would I get sick?
Seven,
yeah.
eight?
I've not been sick once since I started this thing.
Yeah, there was a...
And so maybe it's that I was suppressing my immune system before and now I'm normalized. Whatever, it's better. It's just better.
It was kind of an informal survey done in the UK and they found that people on a plant-based diet were sick twice as often as other people.
Well,
that's not pure science, but it was out there. But, you know, back to the point about the athletics... you know, I think the higher protein is just supports the muscular activity, but I think it also probably lends itself to more efficient gluconeogenesis, which I then think allows you to restore your glycogen stores more effectively.
Gotcha. And there's an amino acid glucose transfer too, right? Alanine can go right straight to glucose, can it? Something like that.
Leucine
is important for muscle building, but I mean there are a number of gluconeogenic
not
amino
just gluconeogenic, but there's one that there's a like a carbon that transfer might that in there. Goes
yeah,
straight over.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember that either. Yeah. Quite, unfortunately, but yeah, I mean I think there is. Because I was on a ketogenic diet for about 2.5 years before I started this, and I noted, you know, just a significant improvement in athletic
Did you fall into this? Did you just kind of – I forget how it happened.
Well, I mean, I just was just reading and just kind of like, you know, I was very interested in athletic performance and said, you know, what have people done? And then I just kind of found a couple pieces together, some people that have been doing it for decades and doing well, and I started reading some of the older athletes that would do this stuff. And, you know, if you go back prior to – you know, the 1950s, I mean, it was pretty well believed back then that a high meat diet was the key to athleticism. And, you know, probably for a reason. That's what they discovered back then until we, you know, went into the late 60s when the Scandinavians started getting into the carbo loading, where that science came from.
Yeah, my dad, this is, again, just there's no scientific research here, but this is just, you know, a interesting story. My father was a business consultant in accounting for many years, but one of his biggest clients was the IOC, the Olympic Committee. So he would work very closely with Olympic athletes every 4 years. For 30 years, my dad was doing that. And he always found it so strange that when he was a college athlete, and then and his father, who was an athletic coach, my grandfather, before a big boxing match, before a basketball game, in the 1940s and 50s, everybody would try to find a nice steak for you to eat, and they would try to load you up on a nice steak. And my dad said there was this radical change he noticed with the Olympic athletes around 1980, where then there was this carbo loading became an issue, and it was a light switch. You know, you watch these athletes going from trying to make sure that they had healthy amino acid delivery to let's eat our unsauced pasta, bowls of it, you know, before our competition. It was just like he said, like an immediate shift.
Yeah, that was based out of the Scandinavian research in the 60s. You know, there's a guy now, I think his name is Art Shrub, who just before the turn of the century, around the late 1800s, had every running world record from like 100 meters up to like, I think it was a 10-mile run or a 10,000-meter run. I can't remember what it was. But he owned all those, and he was almost on a strict carnivore diet, you know, back then. He was dominating the world at that point. And, you know, that's 100 years ago, but still it's kind of interesting.
Let's take a real quick break. We're here with Dr. Sean Baker. If you or someone you care about is dealing with addiction, you know that finding a treatment option that works for you can be extremely frustrating. The truth is, every patient's needs are different and constantly evolving. The people behind True Recovery in Orange County, California realize that effective care can't be one size fits all. This is why they've developed a comprehensive range of treatments that can address all facets of drug and alcohol addiction. True Recovery's master level clinicians maintain small caseloads, allowing them to truly personalize their care. They offer individualized treatment plans from resident to outpatient, always with a holistic approach and a focus on accountability. As patients become ready, True Recovery offers assistance with life and coping skills, school and vocational coordination, as well as community reintegration support. I've spoken with True Recovery's medical director and was impressed with their range of therapeutic modalities and psychiatric services. Their experienced team is well-equipped to manage patients at all levels of care. To request information on how True Recovery can provide you the personalized care you need, go to drdrew.com/true. That's drdrew.com/TRUE. Welcome back to the Swole Patrol podcast. I am Mike Cather with Dr. Drew Pinsky here, of course, our guest today. A much talked about man in the world of nutrition right now. He is the forefather of the carnivore diet, Mr.
You ever think
he'd be
a forefather?
He really is. I mean,
anybody
who knows anything about carnivore, if you hear anything about it, your name will come up.
I'm definitely one of the vocal proponents, but this goes back to, you know, Dr. Salisbury in the 1860s was promoting this diet. The Salisbury steak has got his name on that. And there were guys like Blake Donaldson. You know, he's got a book called Strong Medicine. You read that, it's kind of offensive by today's terms because he uses some impolite word. Well, you guys might like this.
He mostly refers to women as cunts, which is I found that completely inappropriate.
He might have been in a medical journal.
Good for you, Mike.
In a medical book.
Glad you were sensitive.
But there's been several. Certainly there's been a lot of people that have talked about this for years. And probably the inventor of the carnivore diet was some australopithecine from 3 million years ago.
Of course.
I mean, this is where it comes from.
Yeah, you're probably just stripping meat. Is there anything coming off Facebook in terms of questions?
Well, Glenn Watson wants to know what your favorite arm workout is, and he put three fires next to it.
Mine or John's?
It's got to be for both of you two, because I got these pipe cleaners over here. You two both have the gigantic.
I'm sure you're probably
somebody
like
likes
me.
Your arms, Drew.
Arms just a genetic thing. I do 6 sets max a week.
Yeah, I mean sometimes I'll run the rack on some biceps curls, and I'll start with like 90s and work my ways down to 50s.
I like very concentrated lifting, and so that's a very concentrated lift, so it feels good. I like it, but I don't do much of it.
I don't do too much of that stuff. Most of my stuff is a lot of functional type stuff: rowing, jumping, sprinting, throwing medicine balls.
These guys got me into the heavier lifting again. Deadlifts.
No, it's important. I mean, that's your metabolic capital going forward.
You're an orthopedist. You can look at my shoulder for me.
Look at
Dr. Drew's personal needs.
No, we'll do this on the air because I got a shoulder issue, man. It is. It's not good. I thought it was a rotator cuff to start with. No, I need an orthopedist. Do you want to look at it?
Speaking of Dr. Drew's personal problems.
Sure.
Since he's adopted almost carnivore diet, I mean,
You know what? I feel best when I'm actually on the carnivore.
How much do you eat?
I don't have it in me to measure and
okay. Oh, that's fine.
I'll eat a couple eggs in the morning, sometimes with some meat of some type.
Sure.
I'll bring some bacon with me. I'll bring some salami with me. I'll bring some a hamburger with me, and that will be the day. And then the evening, what would you say we eat in the evening typically? For a while there, it was steak.
We're gonna eat. Again.
We've sort of done more steak. Liberalization the last couple of weeks certainly.
Cook you pork.
Yeah,
she
did 20 pounds of pork.
Wow.
We put into little bags, and I just pull that out and take that to work with me instead.
Nice.
I'm going to do corned beef next.
I just don't have the.
Is that okay, corned beef?
Yeah, that's fine.
Because I want to make corned beef hash.
I eat the Onnit elk bars.
Does Onnit make an elk bar? I don't know.
Good one. Okay. And really, very. That is satiating.
Yeah, because I think.
That is a appetite expressant.
That's good. Yeah.
And, when I'm traveling and stuff, I'll just bring that along. And it's very, I'm not, it's not my life, is this stuff. It's just, it started as an experiment.
Sure. He's allowed to eat chicken too, right?
You can eat, this isn't a religious thing. It's about finding what works for you.
At the beginning. He ate nothing but red
meat. Well, there's a lot of people who eat raw meat too. It's kind of interesting I think the ultimate, deal is it's about results. It's, if you want a contrast, because some people say, well, it's just like veganism. I say, well, veganism is more ideology based. And if you want to eat 90% carnivore or whatever, I think the point of that is probably humans do well on a meat based diet.
Yep.
Meat based. We went on vacation. We were on a cruise, and he stuck with it pretty well there too.
I gained a bunch of weight on that though.
Yeah, but you find we drank and you ate.
Yeah,
you did a lot better than I expected.
Well,
I have no problem because I have no problem with it. It's easy. I like it. It's easy. I feel great. I like how within 3 days I felt like 80% better.
Yeah.
My sleep changed. A lot of stuff changed. I was like, I don't want to lose this. And so I've sort of been. That's one of the reasons I've stick with it. I'm afraid to go back.
It gives you a baseline and it gives you a contrast. And so like there's many people. This is an interesting thing. There are many people that do this and probably. I don't know forever long this goes, and hopefully it'll go for a long time, but people will try it. Many people will do it, and then they'll end up sort of what you're doing.
Yeah,
they'll be mostly carnivore, and they'll say, well, I want to have a plate of raspberries, or, I want to have
fruit.
Well, but I mean, what
doing a lot of vegetables.
But I mean, do you like avocados and stuff like that?
Yes.
I mean, avocados are fruit, technically. The low sugar fruits. Probably if we think, vegetables is interesting because we revere vegetables right now. We consider them the panacea. Cheese is okay. Some people, dairy is an issue, but I mean, I think a little bit of cheese probably for most people is fine. But the thing about vegetables is they really didn't come into the human diet significantly until we cultivated them, a few thousand years. And broccoli made it to England like in the, the mid 1800s got to the U.S. Well, in the 1920s.
You got to remember, for all of human history, essentially, we were just trying to get calories in.
Right, and vegetables have none.
They don't count. Yeah.
Right. So what would be the foraging strategy to eat a bunch of leaves? They're going to be bitter. And before they were cold, they're probably fairly toxic. And there's no calories.
Right.
And so you think about what's going to give me the most calories so I can survive. And remember, we lived in the Pleistocene.
It had to be storage was one thing. So bread, okay, and things like that you could get, and it had to be portability,
yeah,
right? And then low mass because you wanted to bring it with you, and then high dense calories. That's what we had to deal with as humans, right?
Well, I mean that's
non-infectious, not carrying infectious disease.
Sure. Well, I mean that's one of the reasons. It's kind of interesting if we look at our anatomy or our physiology. We have our gastric pH from 1.1 to 1.5, which is even in the animal kingdom. There's even other carnivorous animals that their pH is higher. It's 2. The lower the pH, the more acid there is. And we are on par with hyenas and vultures. And that's because probably when we first started evolving, back maybe say 3 million years ago or whatever you want to say,
foragers,
we were probably scavenging. Yeah. Animals, and they were heavily contaminated with pathogens, and so we have this very acidic stomach to deal with that stuff. But I mean, back to what was the solution for getting calories back then? And, so vegetables probably weren't around because they were no calories. Fruit you probably would have eaten, periodically where it was, depending where you were. Now, remember, humans colonized the earth.
But you wouldn't store it. You just eat it off
the tree. No, you'd eat off the tree. You might carry a little bit with you, but, I mean, you basically eat off the tree. But, I mean, we live in this time. So it's interesting. There's a professor, Felisa Smith, at the University of New Mexico, who did a survey of the size of animals. So if we take all the animals in the world, all the terrestrial animals in the world and mammals, and add them up and say, what's the average size? Like I take the elephants and the elks and the buffalo and the deer and the mice and the cats and the dogs and all the animals in the world.
Mammals.
The average size of a mammal today is about 20 pounds.
Yeah.
Say 100,000 years ago, the average size of a mammal was 1,100 pounds.
During the
Pleistocene. Yeah. So we had that just roaming giant, vast, giant animals everywhere.
Wow.
And humans were extremely, the main target is kind of sad because our main target were proboscidean animals. So the big elephants, the mammoths. And, Homo erectus, which was around for about 1.8 million years, they were one of our predecessors, figured out how to kill these animals. And they did just with a spear. I had a really interesting anthropologist, Mickey Bendora, on the podcast. He's out of Tel Aviv. And, it's very easy for humans to kill elephants. Not hard at all. Even with just a blunt, just a regular plain old spear, not even a bow and arrow. So they were eating mammoths at will. Basically, their studies said they could just do it at will. And so,
want some mammoth meat?
Yeah, I know.
It was very fatty, so that's why a lot of people end up gravitating to these fattier cuts of meat, just because there's more satiety. I think that's what we probably prioritize. I mean, you think about it. Am I going to chase a bunch of chickens around and get some lean chicken breast, or am I going to kill one mammoth? How many chickens do I have to kill with a spear? And the only technology I have is a spear, so it's like kill a mammoth, maybe get some fruits. The underground storage organisms, like the roots,
potatoes,
and the tubers, they were very starchy. They weren't very starchy. They were very fibrous back then.
Right.
So you wouldn't have gotten much nutrition out of those either. So you might have done some of that, but I think the majority of it was, just big fat animals.
Well, let's talk a little bit about plant-based diets there. So our cardiac colleagues are totally invested.
Many of them do. Yeah,
pretty much.
I'd say a large percent of them.
So like if I had a heart attack, I'd be put on a plant-based diet, right? I mean, I don't know anybody that doesn't do that these days.
Let's hope that doesn't happen.
Well, see, I have a bad family history.
I heard you've got large vessel disease.
Large vessel disease. And so I worry about this stuff all the time.
Sure.
And it's why I'm not coming off a statin.
Sure.
Because I feel like I'm doing something that way. And my LDL has been, 110, 130 in that zone with a low HDL forever.
But now you've got a better ratio.
I got a much better ratio right now, both with this diet and with the statin.
What about like high sensitivity C reactive protein? Is that down, or have you checked
my CRP? I have not checked that recently. It's never been up. Okay. But that's this. That's
Please
I have I have metabolic syndrome.
Right, sure.
So if this is down, I'm sure that's down too. I'm putting it in my gut.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So if I had a high CRP, I have a calcium score of zero.
Coronary calcium score. Me too.
Mind-blowing to me, but I got on a statin very, very early because I was worried about all this stuff.
Sure.
Balancing these concerns out. Now, here I am 10 months into a carnivore diet. how do I would be more worried if I were 30 on this diet, obviously, sure, and trying to stay on it for 40 years, as opposed to at 60, like I am now, thinking, am I going to stay on it 10 years or not? How do I really do that risk assessment?
Well, I mean, you know, again, if we look at all the risk factors for cardiovascular disease, yeah. I mean, LDL cholesterol is one risk factor.
Yeah, I understand.
And it's not the whole – I mean, there are some people out there that will say it is causative. I think that's controversial.
It's weird. It was – I just did the MKSAP. You know, as internists, we do these update medical education things every 3 years, and they had it – it's bizarre how the pendulum swings back and forth. The last one I just completed, big – pushing aside LDL, making sure we assessed all the other risk factors. Sure. Now all of a sudden, LDL's up front again.
Is it interesting? I think there's something called the MESA calculator. I think it's called the Multiple Epidemiology Atherosclerotic Assessment or something like that. But that one includes a CAC scan because you've got your coronary artery calcium scan, which is a big part of the picture. So you know what's going on, or at least you have a pretty good idea.
Do you know what that is? Do we need to explain what that is?
A CAC scan?
It's coronary artery
scan
calcium.
Scan my CAC.
Yeah, that's it. Maybe you get one of those. But it's a coronary artery calcium scan, and so it's a CT scan, x-rays, and it shows you if any calcification is synonymous with
something.
You know,
some endothelial something.
Right. There's some calcium in the vessel that's part of a late stage atherosclerosis. Yeah. And so if it's zero, it puts you on a very low risk list strata for future cardiovascular.
I should redo it. Mine was about 4 years ago and I lasted.
So we have a question.
Yeah.
What do you use for digestive purposes?
I don't understand what that means.
What kind of, like, you know?
Oh, this is a good example.
Fiber.
I was going to say.
So I don't eat any fiber.
So I do. I just eat psyllium husk. And when people go, there's no fiber in a carnivore diet, so fine, I take psyllium husk.
Right.
Now there is.
Don't you take Metamucil too?
That's psyllium husk. Why do people get all worked up about that?
Well, that's bizarre. There's obvious.
This is the colon cancer story now.
Well, it's not.
Maybe.
It's part of the colon cancer story. Yeah. But, I mean, it's more that, you know, fiber has, really since about the 1960s, since Dr. Dennis Burkitt came back from Africa and saw Africans ate more fiber and had less heart disease. So, therefore, you know, Yudkin made the same observation that they eat less sugar. But it was like, well, they ate more fiber. Don't worry about the sugar. Yeah,
this is the concern when people make dietary observations.
Right. So, it's like, well, it must be, obviously, it's eat more fiber, and therefore fiber is good for us. And then we look at the epidemiology studies, and people that eat more fiber, you know, usually via things like vegetables and stuff like that, tend to eat less junk. I mean, if you're eating a bunch of fiber in your diet, you're probably eating less donuts. I mean, that's just the way it works. And so, we've got, again, this epidemiology that shows that people that eat more fiber have less heart disease, have less cancer, live longer, so on and so forth. So we make this proclamation, well, therefore, we need to have fiber. You know, fiber is completely indigestible by humans. No mammals can do it. In fact, there's very few animals. Bacteria are the only things that can digest cellulose. And so even termites can't. They have to have bacteria to help them do that.
Cows don't do that?
Cows can't. Cows depend upon a rumen which is filled with bacteria or with bacteria. And so that's why they can do it. They're very fit, and that's why they've got this four-chambered stomach.
Yep.
But we can't digest it. In fact, our fermentative capacity, if we look at comparative animals between humans and other animals, it aligns very closely with cats and dogs. About 15 to 17% of our digestive capacity is available for fermentation, which would be the cecum and the colon. And that's almost identical to what cats and dogs are. And cats and dogs generally eat a pretty much of a, you know, not a plant-based diet for the most part. But fiber, you know, again, all this epidemiology, which I believe, and I think a lot of people find is not particularly helpful, saying that you should eat fiber. But there are some, you know, there are some studies out there that will show that if you eat fiber in your diet, you'll have less blood glucose excursion, which makes sense. If you eat an apple versus drinking a big bunch of apple juice, you'll have less of a blood glucose swing, which is a good thing. Now, on a carnivorous diet, your blood glucose doesn't really go up because that's kind of a moot point. The other thing is, in some studies, it shows that it reduces cholesterol, and so again, that's, you know, maybe that's a benefit, maybe it's not. That's contentious. We do know that, you know, there's a lot of, again, there's associational studies showing that if your cholesterol is low, particularly after a certain age, it's associated with higher risk for all-cause mortality, cancer, neurodegenerative diseases.
Colon cancer.
And colon cancer.
And I don't think the bald in fact,
wait, say that again.
So if you get after a certain age, I think it's like 50s or 60, the lower your cholesterol is, the higher risk you are to die of all causes, to have cancer, to have neurodegenerative diseases and infectious diseases.
Oh.
So cholesterol is there for a reason. It's not like we make this molecule to kill us.
What would be a normal or good cholesterol at over 50?
You know, it's I mean, the studies on there show something up to about 240, you know, for total cholesterol. It used to be 240.
What would be
used
low?
To be.
In that those original studies, it was LDL below 150 or below back then.
Yeah, now they went below 100. Yeah. You know, and so
I beg your pardon. The LDL were very low, like 60 or 50. They were super low that they started seeing the colon cancer risk go up.
Okay.
Super low.
Yeah, sure.
But
some people say it's reverse causation. They'll say, well, you already have cancer, and that's why your cholesterol is getting used up. But there was a recent study. It was a 20.
But do you have to have the gene, too?
There's probably a lot of things going on. Again, this is the problem that people have. And we become very myopic on focusing on one biomarker. And the problem is we're complex systems. In human beings, you can't just say, well, your LDL cholesterol is high, therefore you're at risk for heart disease. No, you have to say, what was my coronary artery calcium scan? What's my what's my insulin status? You know, am I diabetic? Do I have diabetic pathophysiology? What's my level of inflammation? What do my triglycerides and HDL look like? I mean, what is my visceral fat load? What is my exercise capacity? What does my lean muscle mass look like? All of those things together are what you got to look at. So you can't just pull one risk factor up, because you could say, okay, well, I can lower my cholesterol by going on a plant-based diet, but guess what? My triglycerides may go up higher. Guess what? I may lose muscle mass. Guess what? I may gain visceral body fat.
Right.
I may, you know, so.
I think the visceral body fat is a key. I think that's
a bigger deal than we know.
That's my sense of it is as somebody who goes up and down with that stuff.
Right, sure. You feel better. I mean, it's inflammatory. And this is interesting. This is just an aside, but we know, I think Stephen Guillenet had a nice paper in 2015 that shows, again, this is back to the seed oil stuff, that Americans over the last 50 years have seen something like a 40% increase in their own body fat concentrations of omega-6 fatty acids, which we get from all these, soybean oil and safflower oil and corn oil that we've been eating for years and years. And it sits around in our tissues and stays in there for several years. And that's why a lot of people on this diet or other diets will notice they continue to get better. Like, I'm still getting better over two years into it.
Crazy.
I still feel better, probably because I'm finally just turning over that crappy old soybean oil I had in my body.
And that inflammatory piece, again, like guys like Jordan Peterson have been on this diet. His daughter's on it and claimed resolution of what he is. We don't know what's going on there, but being called rheumatoid arthritis, his osteoarthritis. You're a joint doctor. Are you seeing lots of improvement?
Absolutely. There are three.
I have not had that, I got to say.
Well, it's
you're going to fix my shoulder
today.
We'll see
if we can do that. There are, and I've just been collecting, compiling all these anecdotes and categorizing them by, if you go to meatheals.com, you can look up, you can type in arthritis and it'll show you everybody that's had arthritis, it goes away. But joint pain, digestive problems, and mood, which is in your area, are the three biggest things.
Mood, I've seen improvement. Sleep and improvement.
Yeah.
Energy.
Less
improvement.
Snoring.
Less snoring.
Less snoring.
So,
yeah, sure.
But that's probably because this is gone, right?
That helps you sleep better and you guys feel better. But I've definitely seen joint pain and not only things
good
like inflammatory.
Good for you.
We joke about that, but I mean, it's an extremely important indicator of health.
Yeah.
I mean, if everything's working, you know, in that regard, then that's a good sign.
It's helpful,
you know,
after prostate cancer.
No, it's very good.
I heard, that's right.
He doesn't shoot loads.
I have no prostate. Yeah. Mike's enamored with that.
The goodness. Ladies dream of it.
Goodness.
Yeah, it's a real divide between men and women, because men dream of fire hoses and women are like, is there any way this cannot come out at all?
Can we get rid of this prostate thing?
Goodness. That's I don't know, maybe people will be advocating for that pretty soon. It might be.
It's removal.
Me Too movement, part of it.
Goodness.
This will be Me Too removement.
You know, but back back to the when we're talking about
HDL's up.
When we talk about visceral adiposity, that's either the central obesity, but more importantly, the fat that sits around the pancreas and the liver and so on and so forth, and the omentum. You know, that when we talk about colon cancer, because 2015 World Health Organization says, you know, red meat, processed meat, you know, class 1, class 2 carcinogen, you know, relative risk 17%, 18%, you know, which, you know, it sounds kind of scary. But if you look at the absolute numbers, absolute risk, you know, lifetime risk for colon cancer, 4%, now it goes up to 5% if you eat meat versus not eating meat. Okay, so it's like, well, that's a risk factor, sure.
If you have the genetics.
Well, but here's the more important thing. What else puts you at risk for colon cancer? So, visceral adiposity, you know, if you look at the studies on that, that's something like 300-400% relative risk increase. So that alone just
right
minimizes.
That's what
that.
I keep saying. That's been my sort of mantra about right. this diet. I mean, since we last talked, that's been the piece I've been saying, which is I have a feeling, my instinct is that visceral adiposity, removing that has so much benefit that it outweighs substantially the other stuff.
Absolutely.
And I think there's something that Susan's alluding to, which is you can now test for some of these cancer risk genes. Mm-hmm. And so it turns out I have what's called an MSH6.
Color.com.
It's a place called color.com. You go, you spit in the thing, mm-hmm. and for $200, they'll do the 30 things that are like BRCA from many other different.
Right.
So I have a Lynch syndrome, it turns out, which if remember we in medical school where they call it polyposis.
Okay,
remember?
Right.
And so it turns out there's 6 variants on that, and they all carry more or less risk for colon cancer. And guess how you get rid of the risk? Or you manage the risk. Heavier screening. So now my screening's done every year as opposed to every 3 years. And guess what? Now it's back to where everyone else's risk is. So all these things, like the 5%, you know, from 4% versus 5%, this is all stuff to be taken into consideration when you're planning out your screening procedures. Doesn't mean you should necessarily avoid a certain diet because of that risk.
Right.
Right? Does that make sense?
No, it does. Yeah. It does. You know, but,
we eat a lot of red meat in my family.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there's
once a week.
There
lots
is,
of bacon.
It's kind of, this is interesting. So if we look at, and this is something, 2018,
no
the study came out of Asia looking at all the epidemiologic studies in Asia. Asia's not a small place, right? How many people live in Asia? 4.5 billion people. Most of the people on the planet live in Asia. When you look at Asians and you look at red meat or processed meat, doesn't matter how it's cooked, whether it's eaten raw, cooked, you know, cooked, burnt, seared, whatever. There is zero association with colon cancer in Asians, Asia. So the question is, okay.
They have more stomach cancer, though.
They might have more stomach cancer. But
they think that's the smoked fish.
It could be something else. But I mean, as far as colorectal cancer, and that's the boogeyman for eating red meat, is it only occurs in Western societies. And so
maybe there's something else.
Well, then you say, what about maybe it's a genetic thing that Asians have. Well, guess what happens when Asians move to the U.S.?
They get the normal
They get
risk.
The same amount of colon cancer as everybody else. The risk goes way up. So it's not, in my view, it's not the red meat. It's the French fries. It's the Coke.
Right.
Stuff that goes with that.
Well, and we do know
they eat a lot of vegetables.
This
too.
Is Kate Shanahan's thing. The kinds of fats we're using right now, the fryer foods in and whatnot, are absolutely carcinogenic for
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
And so, and this is back to the seed oil thing too,
right.
which is also adding to that risk. So here we are. It's complicated.
It's complicated.
That's the bottom line.
Well, and you know, again,
so that's why people get, when the people get sort of crazy about it, I'm like, whoa.
Well, you know what bothers me is when people get crazy about it who have absolutely zero scientific training.
Well, that's
and
the
they
other...
just start spracking off at the mouth, and I who have zero scientific training, know enough to know that I don't know, so that I look at them and I'm like, shut the fuck up.
Well,
like, shut the fuck up with your claim that, you know, meat isn't nutritious. It's devoid of... What do you know?
It's obviously nutritious. Yeah. I mean, it's probably, in my view, it's the most nutritious thing on the planet. But I mean, you know, but speaking of scientific training, I mean, you know, I think Dr. Drew and I will admit... We don't know it all. I mean, there's so much we don't know.
This is the point. We're actually not even making a scientific case so much as a building a I wouldn't say building a narrative, accumulating evidence and thinking it through scientifically. But this isn't science. I looked at Kate for the science, and she guess what she says? It's too complicated. We can't say anything.
Sure.
And so all we can do is try to build an understanding through the available evidence we have, and be careful in our thinking and not be overly anecdotal, but also not be overly dogmatic about stuff.
Right, sure.
Just like you were saying with the Japanese and their colon cancer risk. There's myriad of influences here, and to say one thing is causational as opposed to, these are associations, let's try to figure it out. Very different kinds of thinking.
Lots of tentacle porn. I think that, you know, that's we have to factor that in with the Japanese.
That's over here now.
Yeah.
Is that reduced colon cancer risk?
I don't know.
What is it? Tentacle porn?
Tentacle porn.
Don't.
Maybe I don't want to open this can of worms,
do it,
right?
Don't.
A can of tentacles here. Goodness.
Dr. Baker, one thing.
Yeah, tell me more about the tentacle porn. No, I'm kidding.
You don't want
to
know.
Getting to Dr. Drew and his experience.
Right.
One thing that I know, I've noticed.
Is he a nicer person now?
Maybe not. Doctor's always been a damn nice guy.
We don't spend as much time together, so you wouldn't know anymore. But I'm curious what you're observing.
You should be asking me that.
One thing that I notice in your training, Dr. Baker, that I think is missing from a lot of people's training, especially those that are aging, is the use of explosive movements, jumping. And I think that... people can benefit greatly, even if they're not competitive athletes
right.
from incorporating these movements into their training. Would you agree that that is something that I feel like the above and beyond just lifting heavy weights, there needs to be some type of explosive movement to keep the body young.
Please define. I'm never sure what you're including in that, because sometimes I feel like a deadlift is an explosive.
No, absolutely. I mean a deadlift is, you know, a quick lift would be an Olympic lift. So I mean, you know, yeah. as far as I mean, I agree to a point. I do think it's important to preserve that. I mean, I can tell you how many people, guys 45, 50, 60 years old, pull their bicep off, pop their Achilles tendon, and you have to sew them back. You know,
is that because they're suddenly starting to work?
Well, I think what's happening is their tissue quality is poor, and I think diet tremendously impacts their tissue quality. In fact, if you look at animal studies, there's something called a burst point where if animals are fed a certain way, if they eat too much garbage, their tendons start spontaneously bursting. Their fascia starts to burst because of what's in their diet. So I think humans are seeing the same thing. Now, you know, if your diet is good, you know, like you know, whether or not your joints don't hurt. My joints don't really hurt. Now, you know, I'm 52, and so but I can still jump and do all those things, and so I continue to do those things. But I do agree that aside from being strong or, you know, having, you know, maintaining lean body mass through things like bodybuilding, we should be fit. You know, we should have decent conditioning. We should be able to run and sprint. But doing jumping, you know, and so what I do, you know, for lower body, it's easy to just jump. I mean, that's a pretty way to do that. But for the upper body, it becomes more challenging. So I use a heavy use of medicine balls where I go in there and I throw them explosively as possible. And I literally try to break the things. I have broken several of them. Just trying to, the gym got mad at me because I was breaking their medicine balls. And all I guess they have metal filings in there, so they're falling out all over the place. And so, but the Olympic lifts, you know, you don't have to get technical and do a snatch, you know, high pulls. Right. You know, they do the same thing for the most part. Jump shrugs, jumping rope is something that's just a basic athletic skill, and I think that's something that
I see that as being so deficient. I know plenty of guys, you know, working out at Gold's Gym in
right,
Venice Beach.
Right,
there's 50, plenty yeah. of guys that are 50 plus that right. can lift heavy.
Right, sure.
But
sure.
they walk like Quasimodo, right, and they have
move,
trouble
right.
getting upstairs.
Right, sure.
And I think that it's just an important something that I've noticed. Almost exclusively in your training, that I think should be used more often, and part of everybody's protocol is these medicine ball movements, jumping, skipping rope, things that are incorporating movement and preserving those movement patterns.
Well, we got to look at why are we training? Are we training for a bodybuilding competition, or are we training to live? And I tend to fall more in the latter. My arms are so damn long, I'd never bodybuild. But I mean, I think that is an important point. But again, we'll go to, you know, guys like Ronnie Coleman. You know, Ronnie Coleman, yeah. you know, was arguably one of the greatest bodybuilders ever to live, right?
Easily, yeah.
And now he's an invalid. I mean, he's.
Well, a lot of them are dead.
Well, a lot of them are dead. And stuff. You know, I mean, there's steroids, but then there's the same thing. I mean, you know, maybe it's the diet that has an impact. You know, I don't know if you remember, Clarence Bass?
I do. Oh, yes.
So Clarence Bass, you know, both of his hips replaced. Now, granted, he's an older guy, but again, you always wonder back, maybe, you know, a high carb diet cause joint wear up, because that's the one thing that I've seen, and I don't necessarily demonize all carbohydrates. I don't necessarily think the carbohydrate molecule is a problem. I think what it's sort of complex with, and so certain foods, particularly a lot of our modern foods, the refined grains, you know, the seed oils, all that stuff, how that comes, that's problematic. But for other people, it's you know, if we look at certain, you know, most plants in the wild will kill you if you eat them. The majority of
absolutely.
Them, you know, 98% of the plant material on Earth you cannot eat. Yeah. It will make you sick or you'll die.
And people are like, oh, it's natural. It's natural. Yeah, that's there to defend the
right.
plants.
But
so
even,
you don't
you know,
eat it.
But even the stuff we take, like caffeine. You know, caffeine is, what is the purpose of caffeine in a plant? It's an insecticide. That's why caffeine exists, to kill bugs. It's not for your benefit to taste good. But this is a reality of stuff. You know, people get all excited about drinking their spinach and kale smoothies, but I mean, there's a lot of oxalates in there. Oxalates, the number one
kidney
cause
stones.
Of kidney stones are oxalates. And so you got to look at this stuff and say, okay, there's phytonutrients, there's antioxidants, but first of all, antioxidants probably don't even work.
Right.
Exogenous ones, they don't, certainly if they're vitamins, they're of no benefit and potentially harmful. At least the studies look at that. But people are like, well, I'm going to get the goji berry, I'm going to get the thing that's full of antioxidants. Well, the human body has its own antioxidant system that we design. We have glutathione, we have, you know, superoxide dismutase, and all these other powerful antioxidants that work very well for us in the amount we're supposed to eat. And incidentally, on a low-carbohydrate diet, your endogenous antioxidants go up, which is something a lot of people don't know that. So if you're on a low-carbohydrate diet, your glutathione levels will go up. So
that's why I'm getting sick.
Potentially. I mean, there's also some of the role that we think the cholesterol may play a role in immune defenses.
That makes sense.
I mean, back to your point about, you know, let's mitigate all risk factors. And so for you, going on a carnivore or a carnivore-style diet has caused your visceral fat to go away.
Probably the most important thing.
Certainly. Your triglycerides to plummet, your HDL to go up. You know, your LDL is being held in check mm-hmm. by a statin. Mm-hmm. So you could say, well, if I didn't have the statin, maybe it would go up. You know, maybe it would double, perhaps.
Who cares? I'm on the statin.
But that may be just all you got to do to mitigate that. Yeah. And so there's quite, you know, but there's people that will say statins cause problems. They cause muscle aches.
I've been on it for 12, 14 years.
So, I mean,
I'm on the half of the lowest dose of Vytorin.
Sure. Okay.
And it's like nothing. It's nothing. Nothing.
Right, sure, sure.
And it just pounded my cholesterol down. It went from 130 to 70, just boom, just within a few weeks. So,
and it may be, you know, it'd be interesting to see if maybe the diet even makes it that much easier to do that, perhaps. Hard to say.
Everything's easier on this diet, that's for sure. That's for sure.
Beating off?
It's about the same.
About the same, okay.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't do that. He doesn't need to. Okay, so somebody wants to know about protein shakes, which we've talked about before on the show.
Sure.
And any recommendations for good protein shakes besides blending a piece of meat up?
You had the protein bars you made me look up last time.
Yeah,
she,
I did.
She wants to know about shakes. Like, I mean, maybe this is going off the carnivore diet because you have to, like, add other stuff into it.
But. Well, I mean, you know, I certainly think it's better to get your nutrition from food, you know, and you know, as far as, but I mean, certainly if you look at protein digestibility, I mean, the World Health Organization, the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, is going to adopt a different way to measure protein. They used to do something called the Protein Digestibility Index for amino acids, I think, and they're changing that to a new study where they used to look at different proteins, and they capped it at, you know, 100% or 1.0 was the most you could get. And what it would do is artificially deflate certain proteins, and particularly whey protein is probably the most absorbable, digestible, even better than beef product on the market from amino acid digestibility and absorbability. You know, we look at they're changing because they're looking at now is what makes it to the end of the ileum as opposed to what goes through the colon, because what's happening in the colon is a lot of the protein is being the bacteria contributing to the protein there, and so it's throwing
you're
the
not really
calculations.
Absorbing protein in the colon, are you?
No, not really. But I mean, what it's doing is it's
changing it.
It's changing their measurements. Yeah. It's not really because protein is absorbed in the ileum or in the small intestine, jejunum, ileum, duodenum.
Yeah,
probably mostly in the distal parts, but. So they're changing it, and they're showing that now animal proteins are even more effective. You know, the best plant protein is probably soy, but soy has its own issues. You know, there's protease inhibitors. Some people don't like the, you know,
quote unquote. I heard soy helps you gain weight.
You know, I'm not sure on that one. I guess if you ate enough of it.
I heard it's estrogenic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a knock, because it's phytoestrogens, and that's debatable. I mean, there's people that strongly believe it gives you moobs, you know, man boobs, and, you know, all that stuff, you know, but, you know, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I do know that, you know, when we've looked at ileostomy patients, soy protein versus beef, we see that soy protein doesn't get absorbed as much.
It's coming out of the ileum.
So it's coming out of the ileum, getting into the large intestine. So for the people that say that protein causes issues with regard to colon cancer because of protein, you know, cadaverine and putrescine are things that are products of protein fermentation and may be problematic. Well, guess what? Soy protein is more likely to do so than beef protein would be. So that argument to me again becomes kind of silly.
All right, we got to take a quick break. Let's talk about CBD. It's pretty much everywhere today, and it's a topic that I get asked about a lot. My bottom line on CBD, although there are way more claims than clinical evidence right now, many people are using it and reporting great results, and that is very, very encouraging. I want to first define exactly what I'm talking about here. CBD, or cannabidiol, is an extract from hemp. And while you might associate it with marijuana, CBD is the non-psychoactive component of hemp. It's also what's responsible for the calming or relaxing effects many people experience, not the high. Now, about the products. There are a ton of products on the market today. Forgetting the vast array of reported health benefits, it's important to be aware of what you're buying. I was recently introduced to a company called Select CBD, an Oregon-based company that focuses on high-quality ingredients and manufacturing standards, not on hype. Their CBD-based products are available in a wide range of formulations and flavors, each of which is clearly described so you can make an informed decision without all the promises that sound way too good to be true. Like I said, the reported benefits of CBD are very compelling, and I'm pretty excited to see how things develop as science catches up with this booming industry. So, if you're ready to try CBD, I encourage you to check out Select CBD. To learn more, go to drdrew.com/select. That's drdrew.com/SELECT. For a limited time, you can save 25% at checkout with code DRDREW. That's code Dr. Drew. Don't let those dropping temperatures fool you. It's just as easy to get dehydrated in winter as it is in summer. The cool air tends to get us working harder when we're exercising or playing sports, and that's when it happens. Once you fall behind, water and sports drinks simply don't do a good job of getting you rehydrated. I strongly suggest you stay hydrated and stay ahead of the hydration game with Hydrolyte. The best way to stay hydrated is with a proper balance of sodium, glucose, and water. And Hydrolyte does this better than anything else I've tried. Everyone here swears by it, and I've been recommending it to all my friends and family for over a year now. Hydrolyte comes in great flavors like orange, berry, and lemonade, and is available as a pre-mixed drink, a powder, or my personal preference, the effervescent tablets you can simply drop into a glass or bottle of water. I literally don't leave home without them. Compared to sports drinks, Hydrolyte delivers up to 4 times the electrolytes with 75% less sugar. Hydrolyte solutions are appropriate for all ages, and each bottle or package includes easy-to-follow dosing instructions. You can find Hydrolyte at Rite Aid or at Hydrolyte.com/DRDREW. That's Hydrolyte.com/Dr. Drew. For a limited time, listeners can save 30% on Hydrolyte. Just click the banner on DrDrew.com and use code DrDrew18 at checkout. That's Hydrolyte.com/Dr. Drew and use code DRDREW18. Dr. Drew 18. All right, it is the Swole Patrol. Our guest today, Dr. Sean Baker. Go to meetheals.com. How do you continue to hold, not only, I don't want to say hold such a good demeanor, but
I was just thinking the same thing. How do you deal with all the crap online?
Yeah, because there's a difference between having a spirited argument,
yeah,
and a discussion, which is something that doctors have to deal with.
Listen, there's a weird. I deal with it, and I've told you this before. There's religiosity around addiction and addiction treatment too, and I'm not talking about 12-step. I'm just talking about. I've had discussions with psychiatrists where I thought to myself, you're a psychiatrist, and you're talking like you're an evangelical Christian about how you approach a patient. It's just we're just having a discussion, and this is what we find in diet all over the place.
Well, especially with vegans, you take on a tremendous onslaught constantly of people not even questioning you or arguing with you, just talking shit.
Do you want to put the licensing thing?
Yeah, we can talk about that.
Just tell the story. I don't know what it is. But
Well, hold a second. Wait,
I'm sure there's a good story.
Why do you just shit on my question?
Well, I answer your question and I'll answer that one. Right. But I mean, yeah,
well, that's the kind of thing he shakes shit about. And I thought, oh, it's not an issue for me. But
well, I mean, it's a sticks and stones thing. I mean, I don't care. I mean, I've had so many things in my life. You know, I've had people shooting at me. Doing war trauma, playing an athlete getting punched in the face. I mean, this stuff is like, some knucklehead behind a keyboard and saying stuff. So it doesn't really bother me much. I do, one of the things that we're seeing, and this is very interesting, it's topical. On January 17th, I don't know if you're familiar with the organization EAT, E-A-T, and they're combining with The Lancet. So EAT is a organization that was just funded by So this gal, her name is Gunhild Stordalen. She's a Norwegian billionaire-ess. Her husband is like a hotel tycoon, and she's a vegan.
All right.
And she has funded this organization, and they are adamantly trying to change the way the planet eats. They really want everyone to go plant-based.
And then this is for impact on the
this is on a global food supply. For what? It's for health. It's for environment and all that stuff. And there's a lot of stuff on environment we could talk about if we want. But so they're launching this campaign on January 17th. They're teaming up with guys like Walter Willett out of Harvard, who is the head of the Harvard T. Chan School. The T. Chan School of Nutrition. He's very much in the plant-based camp. And so they're coming out. And so on January 17th, there's going to start this huge, huge anti-meat frenzy. It's going to be all the media. They're buying up gazillions of dollars. You know, all these Beyond Meat companies and Impossible Burgers, they're funding all this stuff. There's just so much money going
on. God only knows. I mean, I've had Impossible Burger. They're wonderful. But who knows
what's in them? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, it's on the ingredient. Well, this is interesting because – so here's an interesting – so Marco Springman is a researcher out of German. He's a diehard vegan. He published a study a few months ago saying that, you know, we should tax meat because of the risk of colon cancer. So we should put a tax on meat, and they're proposing like a 34% increased tax on meat and like a 65% increase on processed meat.
God, our founding father is just rolling over.
Well, but you know, all this tax everything, everything is going to drive people crazy. So that's being, but he published this journal. He published this study in a journal called PLOS, P-L-O-S. PLOS was founded by a guy named Patrick Brown. Patrick Brown is the CEO of Impossible Foods. So he founded the journal.
Perfect.
Where the vegan is putting, you know, the data in. And incidentally, in case you don't know this, the World Health Organization, the 2015 decree that meat was a carcinogen, the IARC, the International Association for Research on Cancer out of Lyon, France, one-third of the members were vegetarian or vegan on that committee. And, you know, it wasn't a unanimous decision. There were a lot of dissenting votes. And one of the problems was they said, we need to declare our diet. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. We don't think that's relevant. So we've got all this sort of conflicted stuff
it's
going
on. It's
not
science.
So we have, there's a lot of religion. But the point is, there's a lot of religion out there. And one of the problems is, and this is one of the things, because I am certainly not shy about calling what I call bullshit. I said, this is absolute, and I say that very, very frequently. Sometimes I antagonize the vegans just because it's entertaining sometimes. But, and not that, this is what's misconstrued. I am all 100% supportive of people adopting a vegan diet if they want to. If that's their personal decision, they should have freedom and choice to do that. Do I think their kids should be on it? Probably not. Mm-hmm. But as an adult, if you want to do that, that's fine. You know, if it works for you, great. If it doesn't, then, you know, don't get too tied up in it and do something else. But the problem is, you know, we're seeing these restrictions being, you know, they're talking about taxes on meat. They're talking about restricting it. There's schools where they're sort of enforcing these, right, you know, meatless days, meatless Mondays, meatless Wednesdays. You know, these things are happening. And so I think, you know, again, and maybe I'm wrong. Certainly, I'm certainly liable to be wrong. But if we take this out of the diet and we mandate that, I think we're going in the wrong direction. And basically, we know what happens when you take meat out of the diet. We just, you know, it's not that everybody starts eating beans and lentils and kale. What happens is you just eat more processed crap. That's what's been happening. When animal, you know, if we look at the animal fat consumption over the last 70 years, it's plummeted. The same time the processed food consumption has gone up, because what happens is you're hungry. When you take animal fat out of your diet, you get hungry. And guess what happens? You're not going to replace it with kale. Kale's not going to fill you up. So what are you going to replace it with? You're going to eat it. You're going to replace it with bars, you know, processed bars or donuts or whatever. And so this is what's going to happen.
We're going to go more and more processed food. I'm getting very
hungry. He's talking about this. I went to In-N-Out on the way here. I had an extra bit of time. I drove up through.
You need to make one of those steaks.
Do you like the lettuce wrap?
I don't eat the lettuce, grab the meat. I just thought, hey, it's cooked me up 12 meat patties.
So 12 meat patties.
In-N-Out's only 8 ounces. They're only an eighth of an ounce patty.
So right. So you order four 4x4s or something?
Well, it's just 12.
So wait, eighth of an ounce?
No, they're an eighth of a pound.
Eighth of a pound. Okay,
so eight of them make a pound.
For their 2 ounces?
Yeah, they're 2 ounces.
So
I love it.
So they're only.
Do you put anything on it or just?
I like some salt typically, and I'm not worried about salt. But I mean, I don't know if your thoughts about salt.
Do you get
but,
like a Diet Coke or anything?
I get a water typically.
I don't worry about salt. Pure. Oh my god.
Yeah, but I mean, but it's a pound and a half, and yeah. I had a ribeye and 6 eggs for breakfast. And
atta boy.
Ribeye is. Do you like ribeye? Ribeye is.
That's the supreme. That's the supreme meat.
Well, this is the thing, because again, we were used to hunting these big fatty mammoth animals.
Yeah.
That's what we and it's hard to get that now, and
see,
so that's why
I can't eat it because I always gain weight if I'm not. Oh, somebody asked, you know, if you're not lifting weights, is it a good diet? Like, if I'm very sedentary because I work in the tech world and media.
So most of the people in modern times who have eaten this diet did not come to it from weightlifting. But I'm kind of one of the first guys that sort of populated as kind of more of an athletic guy. Most of the people that discovered this were friggin' desperate. They were sick wrecks. They had autoimmune diseases, digestive diseases, metabolic syndrome. They were just and they banded together and they started figuring this out. And this is how I discovered them. So most of the people that originally started this diet were just sick, out of shape,
right,
fat people who
right.
didn't exercise,
and
they worked well for them for solving those problems.
Would it work for me if I really went for it? Because I feel like I gain weight when I eat bacon all day.
Well, I mean, so again, calories still count this diet. You can't just say they don't count, but you tend to get, you know, particularly if you eat a little more higher protein.
Don't choose bacon, choose
T-bones or something
to have calorie, like I can't have more than 1200 calories a day or I won't lose weight. So
well, that's it. Why would you want to live on 1200 calories a day?
Starvation. But I'm fine. I like it.
Well, if you
as
like
long
it,
as if
I mean,
I, if I
but
don't
I mean,
carbs,
you, but
I
you got to have muscle. You got to maintain muscle mass.
Yeah, 1200 calories of bacon alone. That's like 60 grams of protein.
I used to do that on my birthday every year when I was a kid.
Yeah, but I'm saying 1200 grams of sirloin, 1200 calories of sirloin, that's 120 grams of protein.
That's like a pound of meat there. I mean, you're looking at a pound of meat to get 1,200 calories.
You just need to make better choices.
No,
I just eat
white meat.
So, I mean, if I were you, I would say eat a pound and a half of red meat a day.
I just eat white meat when I'm trying to lose weight. I can maintain with red meat, but I can't lose.
How do you feel though on white meat?
I feel fine.
Okay, well if it works for you.
Dr. Drew's been delivering the white meat for 40 years now.
Hey-o.
But there is a really heartwarming mention here from Bo, and she said I'm not sure, but Dr. Drew Carnivore cured my Lyme disease symptoms, autoimmune after 25 years.
Awesome. Wow. Awesome.
So
I'd imagine you're seeing good results. I would probably see a lot of testimonials, positive stuff. And again, you science guys, correct me if I'm out of my league here, but things with like Crohn's disease and stuff.
Yeah, that's one of the things. In fact, there's actually some literature published on Crohn's disease and the carnivore diet. So there's a group out of Europe called the Paleo Medicina Group, and they've put about 5,000 people through this, and they've gotten very good results. You know,
well, you're certainly not eating any gluten, and a lot of them complain.
Right.
They report they have gluten improvements.
Yeah,
so.
I mean it's a very good elimination diet. And there's people who talk about that, but this is another. You know, if we look at risks for colon cancer, inflammatory bowel disease, huge risk. I mean, it increases your risk by like 3,000% if you have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, and so. What I'm seeing very commonly is people go on this diet and their ulcerative colitis goes away, their Crohn's disease goes away, which is remarkable.
Crazy, yeah.
And so, I mean, and it may take them 6 months or something like that, but that is something that...
That is crazy.
Because if you look at the normal treatment, you know, a bunch of corticosteroids, a bunch of immunomodulating drugs, expensive medication, messes up your immune system, it puts you at higher risk for other cancers. So it's not... You know, if the choice is I'm going to take a drug that costs me $3,000 a month and increases my risk for lymphoma versus I'm going to eat steaks every day,
I'll buy $3,000 worth of
bread. Increase my colon cancer risk from 4% to 5%.
Right. While my risk from Crohn's disease goes down by 3,000%. So
right. It's these competing factors that most people don't know how to think about.
Right. Yeah.
That's what gets frustrating.
That's the thing. Well, like I said, we got to take a big picture view. We got to say we're a complex organism. There's a lot of variables, and we probably still only identified maybe 10% of what's actually out there.
Oh my God!
So every month it's like some new discovery, and then of course everybody runs out to buy the supplement that supports that discovery. But I mean,
my parents loved red meat. I mean, we're Midwesterns,
right?
And we lived to 92 in this family, and my dad ate nothing but cold cuts and sausage and that was all that was in the refrigerator was meat.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, the classic counter argument to that is, well, there are smokers who lived 100 years and we know smoking is bad.
Well,
but, I
my
mean,
mom didn't
but,
live to 100 for that reason, but my dad did.
But I mean,
he
you know.
He just loved fat and red
I think
meat.
Most humans do. I mean, I think that's, we're just, it's a visceral need. And, you know, it's just something that we're designed for. There's a reason why.
And you have a lot of energy.
Yeah, there's a reason why that tastes good to us. You know, I mean, again, the same, you could make the same argument about sugar, though. The problem is the sugar we eat today, the form of sugar, you know, we might have got a little fruit back then, you know, probably small quantities. Right now, it's overwhelmingly everywhere, you know, and you can't get away
but
from
he,
that.
But he swears that onions kept him alive.
Could be. You know, it's kind of funny. If you look at the super centenarians, you know, if you look at all their stories, people lived to be 150, and they all say, The secret to life was eating cookies. The secret to life was eating bacon. The secret of life was, you know, smoking a cigarette every you never know. Yeah. So it's
so how much does 12 patties at In-N-Out
cost? today I can tell you
it's probably about $25.
No. It was $11.
Wow.
$11. See? So pound and a half cooked meat. That's the other thing. The fallacy is this diet has to be expensive. I mean, there are a lot of people that can do this, you know, particularly if they want to eat ground beef. You know, it's $4 or $5 a day.
Well, that's why I bought the pork shoulder, because the bacon's very expensive.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was like, I think I got 20 pounds of meat.
You get pork belly, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I did. Oh, no, shoulder or butt or whatever. And I got 20 pounds at Smart and Final, and it was 50% off. So it was a $40 piece of meat for $20, and we still have some left over.
Eating it for 3 weeks.
Yeah, no, it's...
I've cooked it on New Year's Day, right?
Yeah, still plenty left.
Wasn't
still
it New Year's that we did that?
Yep.
Oh.
Yep. And, we just got back and you went right and did it.
But remember? I made another one this weekend. My son ate half of it.
What'd you make this weekend?
I made another one, a small one.
Oh, that's what that was. Okay, okay.
You missed the whole thing.
I thought it was leftover from the other one.
I did too. But it's sort of like bacon. You can throw it in with eggs. You can do, you know, and it's really good and it's cheaper. And then
I'm really hungry having this conversation.
All right, let's wrap it up. S Baker MD on Twitter @ S Baker MD on Twitter, and then of course
and don't forget
Instagram
about your
well.
Podcast.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So Human Performance Outliers podcast. Myself and Zach Bitter. Zach, he just set the world record for 100 mile trail run. You know, and he's a low carb. He does all meat a lot. He ran 100 miles in 12 hours 8 minutes.
Oh my God!
That was like the fastest ever been run.
That is unbelievable.
He just did that about a month ago. So, and he's big.
That would take me 12 days.
He's eating like 2 pounds of meat every day minimum, you know, and so nice. He's been doing well with that. So that's cool. I can answer that licensure question if you want to.
Yeah, please. Put that away.
So my status right now is I'll get my license back in February, you know, and it was
in New Mexico.
And the reason, I mean, I voluntarily surrendered my license. It wasn't that it was taken away. I voluntarily surrendered because I got in a battle with an argument about the fact that I was, instead of offering people surgery, I was saying, let's cancel your surgery and do lifestyle stuff.
Who went after you for that?
Well, it was interesting. So when I was at the hospital, I said, look, because I was seeing very good results, like people not needing surgery because we were changing their diet. And I said, I want to have 1 day a week where I just do lifestyle counseling. And they said, no, we don't have an appetite for that.
Who's we?
The hospital administration. Yeah. And so
you were working for the hospital.
I was employed for the hospital. Oh, but I was ahead of the group. I was ahead of the group. I was very successful doing thousands of cases. One of the busiest surgeons in the state.
What's your main? What do you
well, I do general, but I did a lot of joint replacements. Hips, knees, shoulders, and then sports medicine, and then trauma. And so, you know, I was on the billboards, but, you know, voted the best doctor in town, all that crap, radio shows, all the stuff you do. You know, I was doing that stuff, and they were, you know, all for me. And then when I started saying, look, I want to do lifestyle medicine 1 day a week, no. Then I said, well, let me be on the employee wellness committee, you know, or let me do that. And they said, so they sent me up there, and the gal's like a vegetarian and said, no, we have no interest in your ketogenic diet at this point.
Right.
And then I said, then there was a bariatric program they started up. And my buddy, who's actually the bariatric surgeon, they said, well, we need a the non-operative part of it. And I said, I want to do that. Let me be the non-operative guy. And they said, no. And then finally I said, I'm just going to do this stuff on my own. So I started blocking my schedule, and I say, I'm going to spend – because you can't – you know, in orthopedics, I don't know how you know, like psychiatry was, but in orthopedics, it was, you know, 5 to 7 minutes to see a patient. And it's just not enough time to do counseling. So I was taking half an hour, 40 minutes with patients, talking about lifestyle and stuff, canceling surgeries. Didn't go well. So I got it – so they then did a peer review on me, and they used my direct competitor – to overview my cases. He said, I disagree with these ones. I asked for a fair hearing trial. We did that, and, you know, it's a very long story. But basically, at the end of it, they said, we agree with you. The cases you did were fine. The patients, there's nothing wrong with the patients. But we found that you're giving the patients too much choice in their care, which is bizarre to me. They would say, it's not a menu that the patients can choose from.
Did the American Academy of Orthopedics come to your defense at all? Or?
No, I didn't involve those guys, but I didn't have a, you know, I got a lawyer after I'd already been suspended from the hospital, Jesus. Which is too late, which I should have done it before.
Yeah.
But anyway, what happened was the state said, okay, look, we've got it. He said, she said, this is what you said, this is what the hospital says.
Yeah.
You can surrender your license and get independently evaluated, or you can fight it. You know, and it may take a year, and it's going to be hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah. I said, well, I'm just going to surrender my license and get independently evaluated. And so I did that. I went up to Denver, this place called CPEP, which is a place that does that. They evaluated me. Said, "There's totally nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. Go back to practice." And so they sent that back into the state. They said, "Okay, you reapply, and we'll give you your license back." And so that's what I did. And so in February, I should have that back. So, but it was a 3 year.
Sounds horrible.
Nightmare.
It took 2 years at fighting with the hospital before they, you know, it took them a year to give me almost a year and a half to give me a trial. And it was just waiting. And so, anyway, so.
Well, Dr. Baker, I'm glad to hear that. And yeah, congratulations.
Me meantime, you work on my shoulder.
Yeah, maybe work on it. Yeah, we'll do something. I'll stick a stake on it.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I wish you the best of success. Not only getting back into the medical world, but with everything you're doing with the carnivore movement, I really do. Thank you for coming on the show.
Sure.
Thank you, man.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Hey, everybody. It is the Swole Patrol Podcast. You can find me on Twitter at Mike Catherwood. And Dr. Drew is at Dr. Drew, of course. Join the email list today. Send your questions, drdrew.com/contact, and put Swole at the top of the email so we can get your comments. And this will get you a weekly email reminder with a link to this show and all the great shows that Dr. Drew and I do, and all the shows that Dr. Drew does by himself, and of course with Adam Carolla, the great Ace Man. Please tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes. Don't forget to rate us 5 stars, and on Podbean or Google Play. All three help us out. We also are on YouTube/Dr. Drew, and hope you can give us all your comments, even if you're a troll and you want to destroy our feelings and our emotions. Support our sponsors and the show. Click on the banners on drdrew.com for the links for special discounts for the products Dr. Drew and I endorse 100%. Send questions and comments to our Facebook page, facebook.com/Swole Patrol Podcast, or on Twitter @Swole Patrol Pod. And be good, be swole, #Swole Patrol.